This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time. On this week's episode, we talk with writer Emily Bruin about fielding agents' calls in toilets, riding around kids, and what it's like when the attention drops away. Okay, so we're talking about making money this week.
I'm really good at this, Catherine.
Yep. So I think you're going to really like this.
I'm really excited to hear what's about to happen.
It's going to be really good. So one of the podcasts that you've put me onto is Starving Artist, and this is a podcast by Honor Eastley, and it's about art and making money. Is that how you, that's essentially what it does?
That's what it does, and I highly recommend it. She's great.
And so she creates an Etsy store, doesn't she?
She does. Oh, God.
So what's her Etsy concept?
She's like a graphic artist. She can do special things. Like, isn't she a musician?
And it's going to be fine.
It's not going to be fine. I'm starting to panic.
We need a product. I've got three product ideas.
Oh, God.
Okay. Are you any good at sewing?
No.
Good. I didn't think you would be. So it's okay. I've got three ideas. Now, okay, we'll start with the first one. I just have to remember what my ideas are. Okay. Close your eyes.
Okay.
So the first product that we could do a Kickstarter campaign for.
Yep.
And I should preface this by saying that so the profits from sale of each of these products, we would donate 50% to charity.
Amazing.
And then 50% to support the podcast.
I love this.
So the first product is the First Time Tea line.
Mm-hmm, we're going to make tea?
Yeah. So
how?
I already make my own tea. I am a complete tea connoisseur, but basically what we do, we come up with our own organic, locally created tea mixes.
Oh my goodness.
It's the first time is the brand of tea, but each tea is like has literary references, maybe are named after some of the guests that we've had on the show.
Oh my goodness.
We do cute little, literary references even in the descriptions of the tea.
Oh my gosh.
Really, really nice. So you get 100 grams of loose leaf tea at the same price point as T2 would offer. So $13 to $15.
Gosh, she's really thought about this.
Yep.
Her face is all lit
actually,
up.
Yep. So the tea, I think the tea's quite good.
The tea's great.
Yeah. So
writers
then we
love
have,
tea.
Writers are totally into tea. Exactly. So then we have, so you're paying say $15 and then maybe $5 postage. And we will have it, so the tea will be released sort of mid-October, November in time for Kris Kringle, $20 Kris Kringle, $15.
Oh my
Kris
gosh.
Kringle. Yes. And then we also have an expansion plan for the tea when we make tea in tea bags.
Uh-huh.
So can you already see that little tea bag with the first time?
I can see the whole thing.
Dunking bit. And then we approach companies that have a social conscience, and in the same way that they like buy the, you know, the toilet paper, who gives a crap toilet paper?
Uh-huh.
It's the first time tea.
Catherine, you are wasted in the literary world,
honestly.
Yep.
That's only my first idea.
Oh my gosh. Okay. All right. Tea is a yes for me. Okay. I'm good
the
tea.
Line. The tea line's going
to
be good.
Ooh. Yeah. I don't know what I bring to this, but you know, I'm here to support you.
You can help in the mixing.
Okay.
Okay, the second concept. Okay, so I can remember as a kid around Christmas time, my mum would take me to Box Hill Town Hall or Camberwell Town Hall, and all the charities would have all their Christmas cards set up.
Christmas cards.
Christmas cards. So you get a pack of 20 Christmas cards, a quote from Claire Coleman.
Oh,
Claire
my G. goodness.
Coleman, a quote from
all the writers in your life.
Yep. And all of our guests are on each of they're quoted on each of our cards.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So retail price point, I'm thinking around about the $15 mark as well. I have no background on printing costs for any of this.
Yeah. How do we work this out?
And also we could do individual cards as well. So a really nice card. The only drawback with this is you actually our target market.
Yeah.
So it would, what would be perfect is actually if it was just me and I could just sell to you.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you are totally the type of yeah. person that sells.
And see, this is the problem because like the writers don't have any money.
Mm.
Yeah. So we need to, can we make it first times for really rich, socially conscious people yeah. who are going to buy all our cards, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I like it. Intellectual property. Okay. Now what about the cut for the writers?
Yeah, well, that's the other thing.
Quotes we're using.
Yeah, that's the other thing we could do. Maybe we get rid of the charity
mm-hmm.
and we do a kickback to each of the writers.
That's going to work for them, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so I that's like the it. Second concept.
Hang on, do we have to draw?
No, we just do like nice running writing.
Oh, nice. Okay, pretty.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice. My yep. No one actually can understand my writing, so that'll have to be yours.
We won't get you to do it then. Okay, cryptic. So the card. So I'm feeling like you're a bit more hot on the tea than the cards.
Oh, the tea I am totally hot on. Cards, okay. Also hot on. I can see a few problems, but,
okay.
you know,
few
let's go with
for
it.
The cards. All right. Now, this next one is, I think there's a real market for, like, feminist, badass feminist things for little kids.
I'm so glad you said that because I thought you were going to say a calendar.
No.
Catherine.
Oh, God.
We can't do a calendar.
Just you and I wearing handkerchiefs.
Yes, I don't know. Our books, proofs, like draft material. It's okay. There's no market for that, guys. No. Don't worry. Let's go back to the badass
probably,
feminist things for babies.
okay, no. This is for like it's like a party favour. You know how you have a lolly bag, those mm-hmm. kinds of things?
Yep.
Or you could put them in bonbons, seeing so Christmas is
nice,
approaching.
Nice, good.
So it is. It also uses quotes from each of our writers.
Great.
But it's our own personal line of temporary literary tattoos.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
Love a literary tattoo.
Yeah. Yeah. So, we get the tattoos custom printed.
How do you
They're
do that?
Each little, you know. It's all, I've got a quote. I'm just
oh
waiting
gosh.
For
you're amazing.
Inkjet to get back to
okay,
me.
Okay, great.
So we basically, we either go with the first time theme and we have quotes from each of our guests
uh-huh.
or we go with themes from our book. So you could do quotes on friendship.
Oh my gosh, amazing.
Yeah, I could do little graphs
uh-huh.
and things.
Graphs. Mm-hmm. I want a graph tattoo.
Yeah.
Like
or
right
we could
now.
Do I'll just draw. Just give me your arm. I'll draw on you with my texter. Or we could do like feminist you know, we could have little different lines. So I'm still waiting for costs. I'm not sure what the costs are, but the shipping costs very, very low.
Very low.
Yeah.
You have really thought about this.
Mm-hmm.
I am so impressed with you.
Mm-hmm.
I will go into business with you forever. Just
ever.
We'll just say this right now.
Right.
Is this some kind of contract?
No. This is binding. This is legally binding.
Tea, cards and tattoos.
So I'm happy to set up the – it depends on whether we go the Kickstarter campaign or the straight Etsy route.
Yeah. Let's – You will hear from us, people.
But what are you thinking? Where's your heart leading at the
I'm
moment?
Really into the idea of the tea.
Okay.
That came from nowhere, completely unexpected when you said the word tea, and I'm totally and
right.
utterly into it. Really
tea.
Like it. Also massive fan of the tattoos, and I can see them, like, you know, readings, little bookstores, independent bookshop.
Oh, I didn't even think of that.
Uh-huh. Having a little line like there at the front, little tattoos.
Maybe we have to progress with both because I actually think the tattoos will be quite cheap to produce, whereas
uh-huh.
we could kickstart the tea.
Uh-huh.
All right,
okay,
on.
Great. And you know what? Why don't we get people to let us know on Twitter or Instagram what kind of literary tattoo you would like temporarily on your body, because we're not going to get into the permanent stuff here. But
yes.
Why don't you let us know? We're excited.
We can't wait to hear. Today I'm talking with Melbourne author Emily Bruin. Emily's first novel, Hello Goodbye, was published by Allen & Unwin in 2017. Emily has been awarded an Australian Society of Emerging Writers and Illustrators mentorship for her fiction writing and has been shortlisted for Hachette Australia's Manuscript Development Program and Varuna's Publisher Introduction Program. She was recently awarded a 2018 Bundanon Trust Arts Residency. Welcome, Emily.
Hello, Catherine. Lovely to see you.
Thanks for coming.
You're very welcome.
So I suppose to start off with, what we're really interested in this podcast is about how first-time authors get published. But to get published, first you need a manuscript. So can you tell us a little bit about how and why you started writing Hello Goodbye?
Wow. Hello Goodbye was a long journey, I have to say. It started out in, it must have been around 2007, 2008, as, various short stories from various perspectives that I would write while my little boy was asleep. So over time, they sort of started to kind of blend together and take shape. And then I started the course at RMIT, the PWE course, where I had some amazing teachers and fellow students, including yourself. And the guidance I think I got from there and the things that I was taught about writing really helped to kind of bring my characters and the story into focus. And I continued to write, and slowly my characters, May, and her parents and all her housemates came to life. And, you know, that was the beginning of the journey.
And so how did you go once you had a completed manuscript? How did it go from something sitting on your computer to a book on the shelf?
Oh, look, it was still, you know, a good another good sort of 2 or 3 years, I think, of really just writing and nutting it out. I remember at one point I realised that I probably should have had a look at structure before I even started the novel.
You're a pantser.
I'm definitely a pantser. I did plot a little bit, but I think, you know, this novel really taught me how to write a book. I had no idea. Initially I was just sort of writing from one point to the next. I had a story in my head, but it was fairly two-dimensional. And so, over time I kind of filled my characters out, and I just continued to push through and work. I think my main thing was that once I had the idea in my head, I decided that I was going to write 1,000 words a day until I had a sort of fairly solid first draft. Once that first draft was down, again, I got to another stage where I thought, I have no idea what I'm doing. How do you even write a second draft? Where do you start? I asked lots of people. I asked some of my teachers from RMIT. And of course, everyone's sort of approach is different. So, I took on board some of what I'd been told. But really, for me, it was just about going back to the characters, looking at them again, developing them further, looking at how the story kind of wove itself together, and kind of working on the same manuscript to make it better. And I just continued to do that with every draft. And, oh gosh, I have no idea how many drafts I wrote, but a lot.
And I'm always interested in this, did you tell people you were writing a novel, or was there a point at which you started to sort of say, yeah, this is what I'm doing, or was it a secret?
It was a bit of a secret, I think. I think it was really something that I was doing for myself, and it wasn't something that I set out to do necessarily. It was something... You know, I was having a bit of a kind of a rough patch in my life, and I thought, you know, I need to do something for myself. And I really thought I need to prove that I can do this. And it was driven by a love of writing, and then it just started to gain momentum. And, you know, because I was writing every day and the story was always in my head and I was thinking about my characters all the time. And I suppose it got to a point where... I thought, you know, this has to keep, it actually can't stop. It's kind of taken on a life of its own. And probably once I started to get a little bit of interest in it, so once I took it to RMIT and, got some positive feedback on it and started to think that, you know, maybe it might have legs, that, you know, I did actually begin to tell people. But it's a daunting thing to tell people that you're writing a novel. Because probably every second person's writing a novel. And the other downside is that a novel takes a very long time to write. So, of course, people are continually, you know, it might take years and everyone wants to know if you've finished the novel yet. And, you know, at some point you do, but there's a lot of sort of puzzled faces along the way. Yeah.
And so how did you know when it was ready, and what did you do to get it in front of
Ellen? I don't know if I'll ever think that it's ready. I look at it now with a little bit more hindsight and a little bit more experience, and I still think that, you know, there's things that could be changed. When did I think it was ready? Look at, I think I probably got a bit sick of writing it. I think I put it in front, well, I did. I gave it to an amazing manuscript assessor and editor, Nadine Davidoff, who kind of took it to the next level for me. And, you know, I felt that once I'd put her changes or applied her changes that it was getting pretty close to being to the point where I might think about sending it out to an agent or to a publisher. I was lucky enough to get an agent in Gabby Nayer, who's amazing, in Sydney.
How did you get her?
How did I get her? Look, I had sent the man once Nadine had a look at it and I'd applied my changes. And really, I took it to Nadine. I was sort of at the end of my tether with it. I was sick of it. I'd invested years in it, lots of an emotional energy, and I kind of wanted someone to either tell me to take it further or just to shelve it. Luckily, she told me to take it further, so I did. And once I'd applied those changes, I kind of shopped it out to a few people, to a few agents. It was rejected a few times, which was very disheartening and disappointing, especially when you don't even get a rejection letter. You just get the manuscript back in the post, if you're lucky.
You actually had to post it.
Oh, yeah, at one point I posted the entire manuscript, yeah.
Oh, who to?
Or I kissed it first. No luck. And then I got the whole thing back again without, you know, without any sort of letter or note or anything. So that was very disheartening. So I reached a point, I remember one Friday night, sitting at my kitchen table very late, thinking, this thing is killing me. I have to do something about it. So I jumped onto the Literary Agents Association of Australia. I'm not quite sure if that's the right name. Had a bit of a look at some of the agents. I had a look at Gabby and just Googled her. And there was this guy that had posted all his rejection letters, one of which was Gabby's. He wasn't very happy. But I was impressed by her rejection letter because she was very polite, very warm, and she gave him some feedback. And I thought, look, if the worst I can do is get some constructive feedback, then, you know. And she said she was, you know, looking for interesting Australian fiction. So I thought, look, I can't really go wrong. I sent her, I think it was a letter of introduction and a synopsis. No, a letter of introduction. She wrote back saying she'd like first three chapters and a synopsis, which I sent. And then I was in Port Douglas with not much phone reception, and I got a very crackly phone call from her about a week or two later saying that she really loved the novel and she wanted to represent me. And, you know, I was just, I can't even tell you, I was beside myself with joy. I felt like I was floating. So.
And so what was the process from there?
The process from there was then it happened fairly quickly, you know, which was surprising because it takes so long to write your first novel. Well, it took me so long to write my first novel because I felt like I was sort of stumbling around in the dark a lot of the time. She had a look at, well, she'd looked at the entire manuscript by that point, of course. She gave me some direction on it. I can't remember, it might have been 8 weeks to sort of fix it up. That included sort of getting rid of the first chapter and, you know, I think sort of developing some of the characters. I can't quite recall. And then she started to shop it out from that point. Yeah.
And did you know what she was doing, or that was just sort of a process? She said, I'll take it around. And
She said she told me who she was approaching. So I suppose agents have relationships with certain publishers. And she kind of, you know, kept me up to date with who was interested and who wasn't.
Which was a hard wait, was it?
It was a hard wait. It may have been, how long was it? I'm not sure if this is the case with everyone, but she gave the people she'd sent it out to a certain amount of time to sort of review the manuscript and get back to her. So I had an idea in my head of how long it would probably take. It was probably a bit of a relief, to tell you the truth. It was like an enforced break.
Mm.
There was nothing I could do. And I think in the meantime, I wrote lots of short stories, which was, I find sometimes a short story is quite liberating in that they're this sort of kind of microcosm that you can, of a novel that you can sort of focus your craft on. And, you know, it's quite contained. You write it, it's done in a week. And so it's a bit of a break from working on a novel.
And so can you describe where you were or what it was like when you found out that Allen and Unwin were going to publish the book?
This is actually embarrassing, but I was in the public toilets at the airport when I found out. So I got the call from Gabby and I called her straight back.
Oh, you didn't take the phone no. call in the...
Not one of those. So, no, I washed my hands and I called her back and yeah, I was just, you know, I was ecstatic. I didn't know who to call first. It was so validating, you know. This had been such a process that I'd sort of emotionally and almost physically, I suppose, poured myself into and felt that I'd invested a lot of time, a lot of energy. I'd spent a lot of time away from my children. And the other things that I might have been doing. And it was sort of, yeah, it was amazing to know that it was going to actually be the thing that had been in my head for so long and on my computer was actually going to be made into something that I could hold in my hands.
So what have been the highlights throughout the process?
Do you know the highlights? I've really enjoyed working with editors. Initially, while I'm doing it, the first time I remember doing my copy edit, sort of, you know, just thinking, oh, what is this editor doing to me? They're trying to kill me. There was, you know, my manuscript was covered in
all kinds of corrections. Because your copy edit, there was a lot around the timing of things, I remember.
Yeah. So there were lots of different sort of timelines that had to work together in Hello Goodbye, you know, with seasons and school years. There was a pregnancy, there was a Vietnam War. Yeah, so there was a bunch of timelines that had all, because it had been drafted so many times, you know, that was sort of all out of whack. So that was about kind of dragging them back to where they were supposed to be, which was quite a feat. And, you know, I think a good editor is just another level of higher, you know, they're a higher level of being. She saw things in the manuscript that just had completely missed. And so although it was very painful. it was amazing actually seeing that her kind of work and my work being applied to the manuscript and seeing it get better. The other highlights, I think, were receiving the book, and I think
that's an interesting one because I got copies of The Helpline as a bound proof a couple of months ago, and to this day have never opened it, rarely touch it.
Wow.
Am very weird about it. My husband Carney's tried to sort of read it in front of me. I've had to leave the room. But you were excited to hold the book, and that was
I was really excited. I think, and I was really excited. I remember taking it to pick my children up from school and just handing it to them and just seeing their excitement. That was amazing. So
the book is dedicated to your
The book is dedicated to them. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, so I think one of the best moments for me was that once it was published, I wrote a little note for each of them in the cover and gave it to them. And my daughter, they were just really proud. So my daughter took it to school and she, you know, kinder, she wanted me to tell her what all the words meant so that she could explain it. And my son, you know, wanted to read it to me in bed, which was, you know, excruciating, but I did. So that was lovely. Just the fact that they could see that what I'd been working on for so long had kind of taken form.
Did you, because I have young kids as well, did you ever get the sense that people asked your kids questions about how the novel was going and bits and pieces? That kids had a sense that something was special that they had acquired from other adults? Do you understand what I'm saying? Sometimes my 4-year-old daughter asks, questions about the novel that I'm working on at the moment or when my book comes out or this, that and the other. And it almost feels like other adults have asked her those questions and she's sort of repeating them back to me.
Maybe they are. Because I do, I mean, people are so interested in the fact that you're a writer. You know, it's, you forget, I think, when you're around other writers and when you do it yourself and when you're immersed in the hard slog of it, that it's actually something that it's sort of this, you know, amazing thing that people that don't do it, you know, just grapple with, I think. So I suppose I don't know if I get the sense of that. In fact, probably especially from my daughter, she has asked me at times when I'm going to stop writing and can I not write any more books now because it takes too much time, which is, you know, quite gut-wrenching in a way. And I say to her, look, you know, it's something that I love doing and I really hope that you know, it's something they take something from it too as they grow older. You know, the fact that you have to be so dedicated, I suppose, and disciplined, and that you do something that you love as well. Yeah. But they're quite insightful kids, aren't they?
Yeah.
They come up with all kinds of stuff.
It's true.
Yeah.
The other question I had was about titles, because I know Hello Goodbye was not the original title for your novel. So what was the original title and what was the process of that being changed?
The original title, I think it had a couple actually. The main one that I wrote under was And Then There Was Light. And I tend to like these literary titles, which no one else likes, especially my publishers. And I sort of, that title for me was, had sort of religious, I suppose, overtones, and it was the idea of someone emerging into a more liberated space from a darker sort of place. But then when Ellen and Unwin took it on, they decided that Hello Goodbye was much snappier, which it is. It worked with the themes of the book, and it was actually the Beatles song Hello Goodbye came out in the year that the book was set, so 1968. So, yeah, they felt that it, you know, it worked. Yeah, and it did. And that was something that I was really interested in, was that, you know, as a writer, once your book has been bought, it sort of, it really does leave your hands, you know, and other powers, I suppose, and other people have a say over what it looks like and how it's shaped, including the title, the cover, you know, all that sort of stuff. And that's, for me, that was really strange to have held it so close for so long and then to kind of hand it over and just trust that the other people knew what they were doing. Yeah, which they do, because I suppose this is what they, you know, this is the business.
And so what about the launch? What was the launch like?
Oh, you know, the launch was amazing.
So what did you
mainly
do that day?
Mainly my beautiful writers group was there.
Did you take that day off work or?
I did, yes. I'm a teacher and my principal very kindly let me take the day off work so I could get myself organised. And luckily for me, I have an amazing group of friends and family who just really pitched in. So I had, you know, friends that worked in the wine industry that kind of got me the wine, and I had people that I had my daughter's dance teacher, who I'm very good friends with, who just happens to be a catering kind of guru, who did the catering and did the serving. And I had, you know, beautiful Kate Mildenhall launch my book and my amazing writers group there. And I was really overwhelmed, I suppose, by the support from people, you know, that I worked with, from friends, from people that I studied with. Yeah, it was quite, you know, it was very touching and it was very humbling. Yeah. Yeah. So it was a great night. It was such a celebration. Yeah. So I've actually been thinking about that because, you know, I've got one coming out next year and I'm sort of like, what happens for your second? Is it the same? Or is the first book launch?
What will you do for your second?
I don't know. I have to think about it. I'll like have to see yours and then I'll get
like
some ideas.
It's like a second child, isn't it?
It is a bit like the second child. It's kind of like maybe you don't put as much effort in. I don't know.
Secondhand clothing and all this. Yeah. Okay, so can you talk a little bit about some of the things that caught you by surprise? Maybe you weren't prepared for when the book came out. Is there any challenges?
When the book came out, what wasn't I prepared for? Let me think. The publicity, I think, the writing side of things I could handle. I found the, you know, there was a couple of sort of like radio interviews and podcasts that I did that I found quite intimidating. Just, you know, I suppose like now having a microphone sort of right in front of your face and sort of there was an interview I did with Triple R actually, which was live. That was especially intimidating.
That was in their studios?
That was in their studios, yeah. And it was pretty funny actually because they'd set my daughter up in the green room with Play School. And
oh, this is the riding life of mothers, isn't it, with little kids?
Yeah.
Child in
tow. Yeah, and so I was in the studio doing my thing and then at one point I just turned around and I just saw my daughter like a sort of frog stuck to the glass. You know, trying to tell me something. Apparently Play School had broken down, so someone very kindly went out there and fixed it for her. That kind of thing was quite intimidating. What was the other surprises? I think once the publicity dropped off, it was sort of like, well, where do I go from here? And that's quite a strange feeling. You sort of feel a little bit like you've had all this attention and then all of a sudden you don't get any attention anymore and you're like, well, how do I, as a single person and as an author, continue to publicise this book? You know, can I publicise this book? How do I go about that?
So that's probably a pretty good segue into the business of writing. I guess we all hope we've written the next Harry Potter, but the reality is few of us have. What did you do? What have you done to sort of promote yourself and your books and your work?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if I've actually done enough, really. I suppose I've kept writing. So I've always, you know, any opportunity that's come my way in terms of interviews or writing things I've done. I tend to just concentrate less on that and just continue to write. So I've been writing other novels. And
you are a very disciplined writer. I'd love to hear you talk about you are extremely disciplined.
Yeah, I am pretty disciplined, I suppose. But I think it comes from necessity in a way. And I mean, you would know as well that, you know, when you've got work and small children and you only have these small segments of time, you have to be disciplined with it because otherwise you just don't get it done. So I tend to write. I'm a bit of an early morning person, so I tend to get up early and write in the mornings. I'm a teacher, so, you know, if I finish early at school or there's, time before work, I'll write. Yeah. So, I mean, lately I've been doing a lot of grant applications and that in itself is a whole different type of writing. But I was just saying, I think, to you off air that you get to a point where I haven't actually written anything new this entire year because I'm probably at the stage now where I've got one book out and one with a publisher. And it's really about trying to make a bit of money to support my writing through grant writing or competitions or getting the next book off the ground. And today I managed to write something new for the very first time all year and it was so liberating. And I forgot that that is one of the amazing things about writing your first novel is that that freedom to just write.
So do you have a plan long term to how you'll sort of marry writing and paying the bills, or you just sort of have to suck it and see?
Look, at the moment, I suppose I'm, you know, it would be great if my books made some money and it would be fantastic if I could get a grant that would pay me because I write 2 days a week at home, so that would cover that. And I suppose my longer term plan, I'm a teacher as well, so it would be great to sort of blend those two disciplines together, my writing and my teaching, and start doing some work in schools or, get some more library work. Yeah, and I think that's how a lot of writers survive, actually, you know, by just sort of kind of keeping a lot of balls in the air. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, final question. As the helpline comes out in around about 3 months. Mm. So what advice would you give me or any other first-time author in the lead-up to their book coming out?
In the lead-up. So I would just enjoy it. Enjoy it. It's the first and only time it's going to happen for the first time. And you've worked so hard for it. And I think you know, sometimes once the publicity and everything kicks on, it's hard to stop and take a breath. And, you know, I think it's good just to try and be as present as you can in the moment and just to give yourself a pat on the back, because not a lot of people have managed what you have and not a lot of people have managed to get published. So, yeah, that would be my advice. Soak it up. Make the most of it.
Emily Bruin, thanks for being here and for sharing your wisdom with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
To find out more about Emily Bruin and her new book, Small Blessings, which comes out with Allen and Unwin in February, go to our show notes. And if you're liking the show, tell a friend, give us a review on iTunes, or log into someone else's phone and subscribe them. We're also on Twitter and Instagram.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe Adie and Harry Morris. The First Time Podcast is created with the support of Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, and RMIT School of Media and Communication.